Hello and welcome to another episode of the Halloween Podcast. I am your host, Lyle Perez. With me today is Joe from the Defectives Podcast, and we're going to talk a little bit about a haunting that I've never heard of. So Joe, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Lyle. How are you?
I'm doing well, just another day in paradise.
Yeah, it's got to be better than here. It's raining here.
Is it raining? It's bright and sunny.
Oh, that's it. Rub it in.
Yeah, I will. That's for living in Southern California, but gas prices are through the roof. I think I'm paying almost $4 a gallon right now.
Oh my god.
It's insane. But yeah, California tax, here we come. All right, so today we're talking about the Serenity haunting. And it is something that I've never heard of. Joe brought it to my attention. She said, we need to talk about this if you need more haunted house stuff. And I was like, okay, that sounds good to me. So let's get right into it. Joe, what do you got for me?
Well, okay. So this one is set in Serenity in Appling County in the state of Georgia. Now, in 1852, Alan Powell Serenity built his family a house, and it was just on a small strip of land next to the Macon and Brunswick railway line. Now, there literally was, I don't think there was any other properties there bar a small station. So they called it Serenity after Alan himself. So it goes, I mean, at the moment, it's still there today. It's only about 0.8 square miles, and about, of the 2000 census, it contains only 237 people and 98 households. So it's not a huge place even by standards now, but then it was literally just their house. And he actually had two properties, but the main residence was the one in Serenity, and they described it as two stories high. It was weatherboarded, and it's L-shaped, so it runs back containing two rooms. And then they've got a kitchen downstairs and a dining room. And then you've got the main body of the house and then four bedrooms up above. Now, Alan and Wealthy Serenity, that was his wife's name, Wealthy. They had eight children in total. Millard, Sarah, John, Samuel, Clementine, Biggio, Robert and Lawler. But as of the 1870 census, so only six of the children lived at the house at that time, and that was Millard, who was 20, Samuel, who was 15, Biggio, who was 6, Robert, who was 4, Clementine, who was 13, and Lawler, who was 8. Now, Mr. Serenity, from all the newspaper clip-ins and everything else that I could read on this, appears to be actually a really, really decent fellow, very hard-working, well-respected, and his wife, Wealthy, she was also a very hard-working woman, often found in the kitchen supervising dinners for any guests that they had staying. So I think they may have had a bit of a boarding house there as well, but it was only the feeling I got from reading the stories. So they'd lived there for 20 years in this house. They'd never had any troubles there at all. But on the 17th of November 1872, Alan Serenity's daughter Clementine was waiting by the train line for her father to come home. Now, the train was running late, and as she stood at the front of the house waiting to see if she could, you know, see the train come in the distance, she was sat there waiting. It was twilight, so not quite dark, but, you know, losing light. She started to notice the figure of a man approaching her. Now, something had made her feel uneasy, so she decided to walk back to the porch of the property. And as she reached the steps, a stone or some object landed near to her. Now, not wishing to appear a coward, which was maybe not, this was her own words on one of the interviews, she sat back on the steps and looked at the direction from which she had come. Now, as I said before, we're not talking about a built-up area. This is pretty desolate. So there was no way this man could have disappeared, but he had. So the figure that she'd seen walking, there was no sign of him anywhere. Anyway, a few more objects landed around her, although nothing hit her. And but they were coming very, very close, so she decided to go into the house. She had a few of her father's friends in the house there, including Reverend Benjamin Blitch, Colonel Roberts, Mr. Sorensen's brother, and a few other men. Clemency didn't tell them what had been happening, but she walked on through the house to go and find her mother. And as she walked through the passage that led to the kitchen, she could hear all like these stones or objects hitting the house from all sides, you know, not just from one direction, but from all sides. So she walked into the kitchen, and as she entered, do you know what brick bats are?
No, I don't know.
Okay, they're small brick ends. So they're just small brick-like, but they're quite solid. Anyway, they began to rain down from all sides, literally just flying from nowhere. And this is in the kitchen. So they called the gentleman into the kitchen to see if they could find who was doing this, but couldn't find anything. Then pots and pans started to overturn. Crockery started to fly about the room, and the coffee pot overturned and cutlery skidded along the floor. Now, the disturbances then entered the rest of the property. So this started in the kitchen and is now moving through into the house. Sticks started to fall from the ceiling, and vases and photos fell to the floor. Now, Mr. Sorensen arrived home at about 9 o'clock in the evening, and his family are there along with the men. And he himself said, "I consider these men to be truthful and honest." And they all came and said to him, you're never going to believe what's happened. And they started to tell him the story. Now, no sooner did they start telling him this than these sticks start falling. And he said the sticks would appear and then fall to the floor before you had a chance to witness where they come from. So he watches as glass tumblers slide off the sides, crockery falls to the floor and smashes, and books begin to tumble off the shelves. Again, brick bats, billets of wood. Now, the way I'm describing it, this is how it was described in the newspaper from when Mr. Sorensen was telling his story. I suspect not everything was happening at once, but certainly objects are starting to fly about. Anyway, they stayed up all night to witness all these events, except for Reverend Blitch, who went, got on his horse and left. Which did make me laugh when I was reading the story, because I thought, if anyone you wanted to stay, it would have been a reverend, you would have thought.
Yeah, totally.
So at one point, Mr. Sorensen was concerned that some bottles of kerosene that were in the parlour would get smashed. So he got some of his servants to take them outside. And he said no sooner had they been removed than one container fell from the ceiling and smashed on the floor. Even though they'd all been taken outside, this thing appeared in the room, smashed on the floor. So this continued through the night until there wasn't really much else to smash, and it stopped on the morning of the 19th of October. So, which is, I'm just trying to work out how many days later, 17, 18, so that was what, 3 days after it originally started.
Okay, and it was just shaking? I mean, what could have caused it?
Well, obviously they've absolutely no idea at this point. I mean, these things aren't just, they're just appearing out of nowhere. I mean, bearing in mind, this was a very well put together house. It had ceilings, which I know seems strange nowadays because obviously we have ceilings, but in them days, sometimes they just have a roof on the top. But this was a decent house. This had, you know, it wasn't like sticks were falling from the ceiling. These things were just appearing out of nowhere. And also the brick bats, like he said, you know, where are these coming from? They're not even objects that were in the house. These things are just literally appearing out of nowhere.
So they're coming out of nowhere. I heard somewhere where the people were claiming that it might have been an earthquake that was causing it, but I didn't hear the part where none of these things were really inside the house. Everything was just materializing out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, this basically, the information that I got from this is from an interview with a reporter that came, which I'll introduce him later on in the story. But he actually interviewed Mr. Sorensen, and he told him all these things. So, and this was, what, 3 or 4 days after it had initially occurred. So it's not like he's having to recall it from memory. This is stuff that's happening there and then.
Okay, so it was a newspaper article that they were doing. What exactly was the newspaper article supposed to be about? Was it supposed to be about the mysterious house?
No, because of the events that were happening. Now, bearing in mind, a lot of people are coming to and from the house because it's by the railway station, and a lot of Mr. Sorensen's work. So a lot of people were attending the property, witnessing what was going on, and then word was spreading. So then the newspapers heard about it. So they come to see Mr. Sorensen and to witness the events for themselves. And they interviewed him, and this was the first account that he gave of the incidents that were occurring.
Okay, so it was pretty much people started to hear that, like, through the town, I guess you can say, that things were happening at this house. And then out of curiosity, other people would show up to witness the stuff. And then the newspaper got involved. They started to go to there
to
report on it. And then that's pretty much how this came about. Because at first I started thinking, okay, if this is supposed to be a newspaper, what exactly are they supposed to be, like, reporting on? Like, there's really, how would they have known that these types of things were happening, and how is that news? But I guess curiosity, at first I thought it might have been like sometimes they do, like, fiction stories in newspapers for people to read, like serial newspaper thing. That's kind of what I thought what was happening at first, but now with more of the backstory, it's more, no, they're reporting on
really
something weird
happening.
Yeah, because it seemed like a lot of people have witnessed it.
I mean, in actual fact, I mean, it comes through later on in the story, but there was about 2,000 people that went through that property and witnessed the events.
This is
still ongoing. So this is the first 3 days. This goes on for months.
So that's the first, like, I'm trying to think of when the actual first account took place, because you said I think
the 17th of October, 17th of November, 17th of November 1872 is when Sorensen's daughter Clementine was stood outside, sees this figure of a man, and then things start getting thrown at her. So that's the first day.
Okay, so this figure, I mean, some people say that this is it's poltergeist activity, and we know poltergeists aren't really considered hauntings per se. It's more of it affects young women, it's like psychic kinetic power is I think what they claim it is. So I'm trying to figure out what role this mysterious shadow takes place in something that's not considered a haunting. If that makes sense.
It does make sense. This is why I found this story so interesting in terms of poltergeist activity, because a lot of the time, as you say, it is young girls or young boys, any adolescents really. And in actual fact, just trying to think of his name, Dr. Barry, it will come to me in a minute. He dealt with the... I'm just trying to find the information here now. The Doris Bithers haunting. Do you remember it was from the film The Entity?
I've never seen it.
You've never seen The Entity? Oh my God.
Yeah, I know. I don't get out much.
It's your way as well, actually. It's in Braddock Drive, Culver City in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
That occurred, that poltergeist. It was where the woman alleged that she'd been raped by the ghost.
Okay, are you talking about Dr. Barry Taff?
That's the one, Dr. Barry Taff, yeah.
Got it. Okay.
So now he says about poltergeist activity that he believes a lot of it is actually people that have had... my mind's not working tonight at all. Not strokes, epilepsy.
Okay.
I can't even say it. Epilepsy.
Yeah, I've heard that as well.
Yeah, and he believes that people that have that, and obviously a sensitivity to it all as well, that they're more susceptible to poltergeist hauntings.
Yeah, poltergeist—it's fascinating what people think it is, because I mean, psychic kinetic power is very strange to me. Like if. It's supposed to be like an unseen force that's causing a lot of this stuff. Like, You know, I use my mind to move this mouse that's in front of me right now, and it's slowly going in circles. Like, to me, I have to think of it logically and rationally, like knowing the laws of physics, something has to be grabbing it and moving it in a certain motion. Like, let's say I recently did the minisode where the Ghost Adventures had this evidence of a brick flying through, flying across the screen, and there was nothing there. There was no wires that made it fly across the screen. And when I was sitting there looking at it, I thought, what exactly is making that type of movement? Because if it's a haunting, if it's a ghost, they pick it up and toss it. And then I started thinking of those motions. What, like, if you look at the way the brick flies across the room, it doesn't look like anything picks it up and tosses it, because you would see the brick lift up, arch back, and then being launched the way it does. But it doesn't do that. It kind of just sits on the ground, and it kind of like flies diagonally and rotates. So I'm thinking, what exactly can be doing that? Yeah. Like, there's there has to be, using the laws of physics, there has to be something that either pushes it, you know, body in motion stays in motion, body at rest stays at rest. So it's at rest. Mm-hmm. There has to be a force that moves it. But what is that force? And that's why poltergeists are fascinating, because there's no force. It goes completely against the laws of physics.
Yeah. See, this is funny enough. There was another haunting that I'd done on our, this is from our first episode, Surrency, in St. Neots in Cambridge in England. And he had some peas that he had was drying out so that he could plant them for next year's bedding. And he had them in a cupboard. And he said one of the tins literally just come flying out. And he said, so basically that's gone through a door and landed in the room. And he said that, you know, there was no way that was a locked cupboard. And he ended up having to get he couldn't even find the other tin. That went completely missing. And he had to go and lock it in an outdoor shed. It was the only way he could stop it from, well, even then, you know, I mean, it didn't matter where he put stuff, it would come flying back into the house. But it wasn't in the house. So weird. But this, I mean, this goes on now, the Surrency one. So it stopped on the morning of the 19th of October. Everything seemed to calm down.
Okay.
A little bit.
Before we continue, it stopped. Is there any, like, because I'm starting to think it's Clementine, the girl. Was she removed out of the house when it stopped? Does it say anything like that? Or was she still hanging around when it stopped?
It goes on, and you'll get a clearer idea when I go on.
Go ahead.
So anyway, the incidents then restarted that afternoon. Now, by this time, the neighbors were coming to witness destruction. So this is, I'm telling you the story that from what the newspapers heard a week later, but he's just recounting the story. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so this has happened before the newspapers really have got involved. And so the neighbors were coming to witness it. So much stuff was being thrown about that people didn't actually know where to look first. So there were chairs, shoes, clothes, and they were all tumbled around the house. And the incidents were described as a veritable witch or unseen devil's hands throwing the items about. So it actually sounds like it wasn't just the odd thing flying here or there, which you'll often see on clips on YouTube. I don't know if you've ever watched any of them.
Oh yeah, I do. I do my research on YouTube.
Yeah, it's my favorite place. And sometimes, you know, you'll see one thing happen, then you'll see something else happen, then something else. But this seems to be just everything was happening literally at the same time. Stuff was just getting thrown everywhere. So it said here, in fact, there was so much stuff you couldn't see where they'd come from, except for when a pan of water was seen to lift. So, but even items from a locked bureau were seen to be thrown about, even though the drawers remained locked. So anyway, the newspaper... Sorry, go ahead.
The stuff from inside of the locked cabinet was being thrown out?
Yeah. So they were finding it outside and were able to say, well, this was actually in a locked drawer.
So it's either it was ghost items that were going through the wall, or maybe some sort of teleporting?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is what This is what I love about these sorts of stories, is because it just blows your mind. I mean, how is it getting through? How is it getting from one place to the other?
It has to be one of two. It has to either be transparent or it needs to teleport, because how other way is it going out unless it's the third explanation would be that it's all a complete joke, that it's all a hoax. I mean, that could be the third and final solution of what's happening. It's really not happening. It's just, you know, third accounts, everyone getting together and saying, hey, let's make it seem like this stuff's happening. And there it goes. But it has to be one of those three. I don't see any other explanation.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you bear in mind, this man's house was trashed. I mean, trash. They literally, by the time, well, I'll tell you as I go, I don't want to ruin the story, but I mean, they had nothing left. It was destroyed furniture, destroyed all of their crockery, everything. They had nothing left. And I mean, I do not know anyone that would say, especially in those days, bearing in mind, because it's not like he wasn't charging people to come into the house. He was actually feeding them. When people would come into the house to see it, he was, you know, giving them, it nearly bankrupted him.
Maybe that was the whole idea. He needed to go bankrupt. So he came up with this thing so he can destroy all of his stuff and not seem crazy.
Yeah, I think you'd be crazy to do it that way, let's be honest. But yeah, he certainly, so. There was never any reports of him being financially in trouble and that being the cause. That was never a reason brought up for the events occurring.
Yeah, I mean, he has servants. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I mean, he had two houses. I mean, he was quite a rich guy, especially for the time.
Yeah.
But as I say, it cost him so much money to feed everyone, basically. So anyway, so the newspapers now start to hear these stories and they send a reporter to investigate. And Mr. Sorensen was working outside when they arrived, and he sent them into the house, and his daughter takes them in and she tells them just to wait around. She said the incidents are sure to occur soon. She shows them the remains of the crockery all scattered about the house, which she assured them had been vases and other ornamental items. And as they're talking to his daughter Clementine, they hear a lumbering noise in the next room, and she informed them that it was a brick that had been thrown, one of many that day. So they decide to go and investigate. Anyway, as they approach the room, a heavy pint glass, you know, the saloon type, the big stocky ones, mm-hmm. that goes flying past their heads with such force and it smashes into the floor. Now, when the reporter tried to pull the glass out of the floor, he had to use an immense amount of force just to get the glass out of the floor. It was wedged so, you know, so much into the floor, into the wood.
Wow, that was a lot of force.
Yeah. So the heavy cast iron, that was also thrown into the room. And they were told that Mr. Sorensen had attempted to go to bed at 3 o'clock the previous morning, only to have bricks fall so thick and fast around him that he wasn't actually able to sleep.
Okay, and all of the stuff being thrown around, were people hurt?
Yeah, there were people hurt in the end, but initially, to begin with, it didn't appear that anyone was, it was, things were landing near them, but no one was actually getting hit.
So whatever is causing this thing, I mean, doesn't seem malicious at this point?
Not at this point, no.
Okay.
No, so only towards, obviously, their property.
But, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so anyway, out of two sets of crockery in the house, only two pieces remained whole. And they said the incidents were non-stop. Literally every 5 minutes or so, something was happening. And so the whole family was suffering from not sleeping. So anyway, another reporter turns up, a guy called Mr. Lindstroth. Now, he was sent to investigate, and he and two other gentlemen, a Mr. Mason and a Mr. James Campbell, arrived in Sorensen before sunrise, and they go to the house. They found it in darkness, but the front door was unlocked, so they let themselves in and found a room that had a smouldering fire in the grate. So they got the fire going and waited for the family to wake up. Nothing much had happened while the family slept, but they did hear a few rappings on the wall, and a couple of times they heard a heavy thud as though someone had fallen out of bed. So Mr. Sorensen awakes, he comes down, greets them heartily and confirms all the stories that the reporters and gentlemen have heard. And he starts to tell them the story. And as he's recounting it, he mentions about the clock. Now he's got a lovely big clock in one of the rooms. And he says the hands just spin wildly. So they go to investigate the clock and have a look at it. And sure enough, the hands on the clock are absolutely spinning at an immense speed. In fact, they claim it is 5 hours every minute. So I don't know of any clock that can go around that fast.
No, that thing's got to be spinning.
It was a third, yeah, at some speed, yeah. So it was a 30-hour wait clock. Now, by chance, the reporter was also a watchmaker. That was his actual profession. He just did reporting on site. And he proceeded to take the clock apart to check for faults. He found none. So there was nothing at all that could indicate what had caused it. They even checked for magnets. But when he looked at his own pocket watch, he actually found that that was running correctly. So if it had been magnets, it would have affected his pocket watch as well. So he set the time on the clock, and it kept the correct time up until they left. So nothing else really occurred until 17 minutes to 12, when a pair of scissors jumped from the table onto the chair. Now, the reporter was sat in the chair, and a brickbat fell right beside him. And he said it fell with such force it actually broke into two. He picked up the pieces, and they were hot. So both the reporter and Mason then attempted to break the brick by throwing it on the floor, but neither of them were able to recreate the necessary force in order to break it. So he puts the piece on the windowsill and he thinks, I'll take that home with me. And no sooner did he put it down, it fell right in front of him and broke in two again.
So, after they couldn't do it themselves.
They couldn't do it, yet this thing's just gone, fallen on the floor, straight in front and broken in two.
So, that's weird, because this, whatever this is, seems like it has some sort of intelligence. They were trying to break it. They're trying to break it. They can't do it. They set it down. I'm going to take it as a souvenir. And then whatever it is breaks it in front of them. Like it knew that it needed to do that.
Yeah. He didn't, as you can imagine, he didn't try and take it home that time.
Oh, I wouldn't either.
So, no, me neither. So at 12 o'clock, he said, a smoothing iron leapt 6 feet across the room and landed on the floor. They replaced it and it did it again. And the reporter noticed that it was hot, but thought, well, you know, that could have been warmed by the fire. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it was the same as the brick. I mean, obviously, you can't explain it flying across the room, but it's not hot like the brick was. So later in the day, he said, oh, no, sorry. Yeah, they all went for dinner then. And as they sat there, an ear of corn fell between Mr. Campbell and Mrs. Surrency, and splitting it in half and scattering corn all about the room. Now, I thought that was quite interesting as well, because an ear of corn wouldn't be that heavy.
No.
You know, so that if it fell between someone, it would have enough force to split it in half. I wouldn't have thought so anyway.
Well, what kind of half? I mean, did it go diagonally or straight across it?
Or... Yeah, he doesn't say. He just said it literally splitting it in half and scattering corn all about the room.
I mean, because if you grab one end and then grab the other end and force your hand or your elbows down, it will snap. But if it broke the other way, I mean, you wouldn't be able to hold it anywhere, because you're trying to hold the sphere, and it's just, you can't break it that way.
Yeah. So, and yet this thing's just split apart in front of them.
I wish I would have known if it was which direction the split was. It would have been amazing if it went right down the corn. If it just went straight down, it would have been amazing. But if it would have broke like I could break it, then it's not as bad.
No. But later in the day, another ear of corn fell, striking a Mrs. Burns, who had a baby in her arms, which I have to say, this really made me laugh when I was reading it. I was thinking, who takes a baby to a poltergeist haunting?
A terrible mother?
I know. So, so she turned up. But this, I mean, really, the point, I suppose, to a certain degree, we're missing is, where the hell is this ear of corn coming from? Why, you know, why is that in the house anyway?
I don't know. Weren't they eating?
But you'd like to think that they would have mashed the corn up or something, you know, rather than... They weren't in the kitchen. You know, that was in the dining room, and I don't know where the other room, where it happened to Mrs. Burns, but, you know, you would have had the corn out, wouldn't you?
Yeah, maybe this poltergeist is childish and wants to do childish stuff. That seems about the best explanation. Who knows? I don't know.
So after dinner, more people turned up, and there were at least 10 people in the front room. And they all stood there trying to keep an eye on items to see if they would move. But then they then falling from the ceiling, a chamber glass smashed to pieces in the middle of the room. So everyone's looking at all items around the room, and something just falls from the ceiling anyway, and no one saw it until it smashed. So while all this fun was going on in the parlour, the cook had to contend with knives being thrown along with pots and pans. I mean, I'm amazed they still had staff, to be honest with you, because could you imagine all that going on?
I was just thinking that. Like, I wonder how many people, like, just up and left. Like, if this much activity was going on, it seems like there's a lot of people that are just hanging around. And to me, I would be like, okay, well, I've seen it. Have a good life, Mr. Serency. I'm going to leave now.
I'm off.
Goodbye. But it seems like nobody is doing that. Like, I want to hear more stories of people going into the house and saying, okay, yep, I see it. Adios. And they leave. But a lot of people seem to be hanging around for some reason.
Well, I think from what I can gather from the newspaper clippings, I think, you know, well, this next bit here, he said, so keen were people to come and see the ghost that the railways put on another train and 75 people turned up that afternoon. I mean, can you imagine that? And he was letting them all in to see it. He wasn't stopping anyway. He never charged anyone to go in and see it or anything, you know. And these people were just, you know, obviously had heard the story and wanted to see it for themselves.
I don't know. I mean, if it would have made more sense if he was charging people, or maybe something came out where the city planned it, and that's why they started doing all these things to make it more of like a tourist attraction for the town. But he was the one that founded it, no? So wouldn't he be like head council?
He was the only person there. There wasn't any other properties then. From what I can gather, that he had some neighbors, but we're not talking next door. You know, we're talking miles away. Kind of thing. So it's a town now, but at that time it wasn't.
Okay, so there's no town. So I'm trying to, I'm really trying to hold on to the hoax thing. But as time progresses, it really makes no sense for them to cause a hoax. Unless they wanted notoriety for the Halloween podcast that we're talking about it now, 100 or so years later. Unless they wanted that. Then I can
I'm
see
sure
it.
They did.
Oh, definitely. But I don't know. I mean, I want to hold on to it's a hoax. They did it for a reason. But with more and more accounts coming, I'm like, okay, well, it seems less likely that they would be doing that. But you never know. I mean, it would make a lot of sense. Like at the very end, you said, yeah, it turned out he was insane and they all got committed. Then I would be like, okay, well, maybe that makes more sense that it was a hoax.
I think this is the problem, because you just cannot make sense of this, you know. And also, I suppose to a certain degree, you just can't imagine it either, you know. I mean, I've read loads of different other poltergeist accounts and things like this, but I have to say this one was, I think it was because you were actually having reporters who were going in, seeing this happening firsthand and reporting it, you know. So it wasn't, oh, they claimed that this occurred and so-and-so saw this and so-and-so saw. They're actually saying, no, I was there. This is what I witnessed with my own eyes.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, the reporters themselves having their own experiences. But, if you think of ghost hunting and stuff now, when investigators go into a place, they don't always see something. But it seems like now, every time somebody's going in, they're seeing something. So that also can throw up red flags. That, you know, it's a hoax. That's why everyone's experiencing something. But then again, maybe it's just so, I guess, for lack of a better word, so haunted that, you know, people are experiencing it left and right. So I'm very curious to hear how this thing is concluding. So continue.
The people that turned up, the 75 people that turned up, it said in there that the ghost actually didn't want to play and refused to perform. And so nothing happened that afternoon. So the train took most of them back, but quite a few stayed. And the reporter stated that on Sunday alone, 500 people had visited. So, I mean, that just blows my mind. I just can't believe it. But another mysterious thing that the reporter noticed was that piles of sugar around the house with a few pins and a steel pen in them. But the sugar wasn't even a type that was used by the house. I mean, that's odd, very odd.
Yeah.
So anyway, he says any suggestion that might have been employed, that this might have been employed to pry money from spectators could be ruled out, as the well-noted Southern hospitality ran true in Mr. Sorensen's house. He took no money from viewers or the journalists, mediums and conjurers that stayed at his house at considerable cost to himself.
So he was putting up all of these people and feeding them and all that stuff. So, I mean, why hoax it? I guess I don't know why you wouldn't why you would have to feed everybody, really.
I think it's a Southern, you know, if you have people to your house and they're your guests, then you don't take money from you for the bill. I don't know. Maybe someone from the South can enlighten us on that. But
yeah, I've heard Southern hospitality numerous times. I don't really understand it because I didn't grow up in these times, so I don't know what their etiquette. I don't know if this, like, what the actual etiquette is.
Yeah.
Yeah, for this type of, you know, for this time period. But I mean, I don't really see that happening now, unfortunately. It'd be cool if it did, but no. To me, I wouldn't be able to house these many people hanging around in my house all the time.
No. Oh, God, no, I know. So anyway, come November, the haunting is still going on. And Clementine states that when she was making a bed upstairs, that she shut the door and she heard a commotion inside, only to find all the bedding on the freshly made bed had been bundled up in a pile, along with every item of clothing that was in the drawers. Now, this had happened on another occasion, but on that time, a set of candlestick moulds that Mrs. Sorensen had just literally stuck into a pot of water appeared on the bed too. Now, the moulds were in the kitchen, so there was no way that someone could have taken them and put them on the bed. One, they couldn't have done it in the time, and two, they couldn't have done it without seeing, because Mrs. Sorensen was in the kitchen, yet these molds appeared on the bed.
And again, it going through walls or teleporting, weird.
Yeah, I mean, that is, yeah. So window panes would also break without any contact, and half a pane had been seen to slide up and down in the frame. And one night, a straightening iron struck one of the young sons in his back while he was sleeping, inflicting a painful wound. Now, the iron wasn't even originally in his room. It was actually downstairs. And one of the servants also got hit by a bottle. And it says in the newspaper, it was a glancing blow and struck the wall, but the nurse was holding the baby at the time. Mr. Sorensen witnessed this and stated it hit the wall a lot harder than it hit the girl. Sure she took great... I'm sure she felt better about that.
Yeah, because it seems like whatever this is doesn't really want to hurt people. I mean, it could have easily thrown it to the person as hard as it could, but I mean, it didn't, and it ended up hitting something else really, really hard.
Yeah, but the straightening iron did actually hit the young son, so it does seem to be now just picking up a bit, and you know,
maybe it's realizing how much fun it could have if it starts hurting people.
Yeah, who knows? So Mr. Sorensen, anyway, he relayed these stories to another reporter regarding the disturbances with the clock. They reset it and it kept time correctly for 3 hours. And at 1 o'clock, the hour hand stood still while the minute hand went round. They reset the clock and at 7:30, instead of standing still this time, it started out at 12 times its normal speed. Now, the reporter, although he wasn't a professional horologist this time, he looked at the innards, but he said it all appeared in order, and then again the clock kept its time for the remainder of the visit. And after a while, Mrs. Sorensen and Clementine did actually leave the house to stay with neighbours, the Pattersons, but no sooner had they left than the phenomena stopped at the Sorensens but started at the Pattersons.
So it kind of seems like it's following Clementine, which it's a girl, right? Female? Daughter?
Yeah, that's okay. The eldest daughter. So that's the one that initially saw it.
Okay, so it does seem to me now that something, it might be more of a possession type thing, because...
Here's the twist.
Oh, go ahead.
Here's the twist. Okay, so this was reported in the Greenville Express, November 20th, 1872. And it says, Mrs. Sorensen and her daughter did leave home during the week and went to Mrs. Patterson's with the intention of remaining there, and as soon as they arrived at his house, the identical proceedings enacted at Mr. Sorensen's began at Mr. Patterson's and ceased at Sorensen's as soon as the ladies left. They remained at Patterson's for a few hours and, not wishing to have his household goods so badly destroyed, determined to return home. Miss Surrency remained at Mr. Patterson's and her mother returned, and as soon as she arrived home, which was about sunset, the very same freaks began again. They seized at Patterson's when she had left there and had never returned, though the young lady remained and was seen there by your correspondent and friends. These strange things have never happened except where Mrs. Surrency was present and always seized when she left, and it is very clear, assuming it to be from a supernatural source, that she is the medium through which it acted. She stated to us that she had never been mesmerized, never saw a mesmerist or a spiritualist that she knows of, read a work of spiritualism, and has never thought of it.
Oh, so maybe it wasn't Clementine.
No, so it's Mrs. Patterson.
Or maybe it could have jumped from Clementine to Mrs. Patterson.
Well, in actual fact, it's quite interesting because in 1905, a reporter tracked down one of the sons. Now, I was trying to work out for life me who it was. I think it's possibly John Surrency, who would be about 51 years old now, working from the 18th, not now, obviously in 1905, working from the 1860 census, this was. And he tells the reporter that the troubles actually started with his mother. And he said she was sat sewing in her room and she could hear a noise, but she didn't take much notice of it, carried on sewing. Anyway, it made a louder noise. And when she looked up, she could see the pitcher in the bowl, you know, the pitcher jugs, on the washstand, and it was rocking backwards and forwards. So she gets up, she goes and checks it for a string or wire, thinking that it was one of her boys messing about, but she couldn't find anything. She checked the house and found it quite empty. There was no one about. She settles back down, and to her surprise, as she watched, the pitcher lifted up a couple of inches and banged back down again. Now, this happened a couple of times. Then the pitcher lifted up and was placed carefully on the nightstand, and the bowl was lifted and it smashed to the floor at her feet. The smaller pieces of the toiletry set were flung at her feet, and the pitcher was then picked up and the water poured onto the carpet before it was violently thrown to the floor. Now, he goes on to say that they were sat at the dinner table when the door to the dining room slowly closed, and he said his mother said that was done by the wind. So she's obviously trying to convince herself that, you know, there's nothing going on. But no sooner had she said that than the door was flung open to its previous position, and two windows that had opened suddenly started to raise and lower in quick succession. And it was so violent that when it stopped, a number of the small panes were broken in it. He said things got worse from there. They would often be splashed in the face by cups of tea, coffee or soup, which would sometimes scald them. Their knives and forks would get twisted out of shape while in their hands, and the tablecloth had even been pulled from the table, scattering dishes and cutlery across the floor. Now, he seemed to think that the incidents were restricted just to his mother's bedroom and the dining room, but within a couple of days it had spread throughout the house, and not one room was free from activity. He said the heavy furniture would move with ease across the floor and then return to their previous positions, and some of the younger children had been hit by falling furniture, pictures and mirrors, even causing broken bones. And he said he remembered an incident in February when he was walking into the hall and he saw his elder brother sat at a table. He said a fire was flickering in the fireplace, and to his surprise, one of the huge end irons, which is the metal stand, typically you normally have two of them, which would support the wood burner in a fireplace. He said one of those raised in the air and gathered momentum before striking his brother on the temple. He said he's sprung to his feet and his head was profusely bleeding, while John grabbed the end iron and attempted to shield his brother. He said the end iron wrenched itself free and again struck his brother. Now, the clip in the paper claims it was his older brother Robert, but it, when I was going through all the census stuff, that didn't make sense, so I'm pretty sure going for ages it was John. So he says, "Run," I called to my brother, "run for your life. If you stay here you will be killed and I cannot help you." He ran, but he said the end iron followed him, striking him until he was unconscious at his mother's feet, and the end iron returned to the hearth. He said they moved the next day to the other farm, taking only their clothes, though to be honest, there was not a lot left of the house to take. And the injuries to his brother took a long time to heal and produced a fever which nearly killed him. So for about a week to 10 days, they had a peaceful time at the other farm, and then it all started up again with even more vigor. And they eventually left both properties, and Surrency built another house for them to live in. So the two houses stood empty, even though there was really good properties, but no member of the Surrency family would go back there. And that's the end of it, really.
It sounds like he remembers it a lot harsher than the earlier accounts, because, I mean, nobody was really getting hurt, and the people were just coming to check it out, and he was recounting his stuff as saying, no, a lot of terrible things were happening. I mean, people were getting hurt. We thought we were all going to die.
Yeah. I mean, I think to begin with, obviously, when the reporters were turning up and they were mainly reporting on what they had seen. I mean, at one point, there was a report that there was a pig walked into the room, and Mr. Surrency actually got quite annoyed about it, because he said, I don't know why these newspapers are making these stories up. They don't need to. You only need to come here and see what's going on. You don't need to make things up. It's bad enough as it is, you know.
Yeah, because I heard a story from doing the little research that I did, that livestock, like chickens, pigs, they just, like, a reporter was over doing his story. They went to the living room. There was nothing there. They walked past. They kept going. And then they came back to the living room, and it seemed like chickens and pigs just materialized inside the room. And then that frightened the newspaper, reporter, that he ran out and never came back. And I heard that. But, I mean, now you're saying that a lot of those things were made up. So maybe that was made up as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, he'd actually said these were untrue reports, the ones about that. He said there was one about a pig that had walked into the parlour, and then when they'd all followed it out of the room, it had disappeared. And there was also one, a Captain Burns had attended and was staring at the iron waiting for it to move. He complained he could do some whiskey, and it had appeared next to him and filled his glass, and then the bottle had disappeared, and he hadn't even noticed it because he was so intent on staring at the object on the floor. And Mr. Surrency was like, no. That did not happen, and nor did the pig. You know, come here, see what's happening. You do not need to make up stories.
So they pretty much denied all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite. I mean, this story it's amazing that no one's really heard of it, because in actual fact, at the time when it was out, I was finding newspapers in Ireland, Northern Ireland, reporting on it in England. You know, it spread. It really did spread. But it was quite funny, because you'd get a lot of the stories. So you'd have the initial newspaper reporters who were attending, they would report on it, and then someone else would read their story and then do their interpretation from that story.
Okay, so you know, the game of telephone, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. So that's why I only really took the information from the reporters who had interviewed Mr. Surrency themselves and had witnessed the events.
So it just stopped all of a sudden, or how did the actual, like, stop? Is it still going on today?
Well, no, because in actual fact, it burnt down. The house burnt down. There was the original house burnt down allegedly in 1925, though I cannot find for the life of me one story on it. Nothing in the newspapers at all, which is surprising, as I say, because it was such a famous sighting. But you do get reports of strange ghost lights in the area. And there's quite a few where people have pulled up there, they've stopped, and they see these strange glowing lights, and they will come towards them as well, the lights.
So this place is in Georgia. Is there anything around there now, like any potentially built houses that might show up there?
Well, when I was trying to research where the house was, there's nothing built on the actual old homestead, from what I can gather. There is a house very nearby, but there's nothing, if I've got the right space, there's nothing built on that actual spot. But that's the thing I could really do with someone from Surrency saying, actually, no, it was here, or, you know, being able to point it out. But purely from what I can gather, there's nothing on there now. But there are houses, obviously, all around.
Right. I wonder if there's any activity going on in those houses.
I know, this is the thing, you know, especially nearby the ghost lights and everything. And I mean, okay, yes, it did appear that it was possibly Mrs. Surrency was the catalyst. I would say she's obviously a sensitive. But Who knows?
In your opinion, what do you think it really was? You think a poltergeist for Mrs. Serency? You think that's pretty much what was causing all of the ruckus?
Yeah, I would say it probably was. You know, well, I mean, she was the main one that when they were around, when she was around, incidents occurred.
Okay, because
The only thing I find very odd is the fact they lived there for like 20 odd years,
yeah,
and never had a problem.
Yeah. So I mean, how did the story of Clementine and seeing that shadow figure come into play? Because if it was Mrs. Serency all along, it seemed like all of the stuff started happening when Clementine saw that apparition, yeah. I guess you can say. So, what do you think it was? One or the other?
I think it was Mrs. Serency, but the only thing is bearing in mind the newspaper reports were reporting about it at the time, whereas John Serency, the son, was telling the story some 20, 30 years later. You know, so he's had, although, I mean, your memory's obviously never as good as it is at the time. So he, and also he might not have known about Clementine. He might not have known about that incident that occurred. He's only heard what his mother's told him. I don't know. It's without the people there to ask them, you've got no idea, really.
Yeah, that's
because he does say, in actual fact, I read a book as well that there was a short story in there that was from this bit, and they said that when they'd had to go back to the house for Clementine to get some stuff out, and she'd packed a case up, and a chest rather, and she shouted to her father to come and get it, and it literally shot out the window and landed at their feet, and so they went. But when I was reading, I was thinking, well, I know, it'd be funny, I wouldn't be going in there on my own. I'm pretty sure her father wouldn't let her go in there on her own.
No, definitely not with that much stuff going on around there. No, not at all. I wouldn't let my daughter go in there. I would go in there for her and do it.
Yeah, and not only that, I shouldn't think she had that much stuff left, to be fair, because I think most of the stuff got smashed.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much of anything really left if this poltergeist or whatever it is just destroying everything that's yours.
But it was quite funny because a couple of the reasons that were given in the newspapers that it occurred, one of them was mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes?
I don't know how they thought that was even possible. The other one, there was another incident later on. Let me just find the clip on it. Yeah, there was a further haunting in Atlanta in 1875, a couple of years after the Serency haunting, and a Mr. John McMillan declared that he had solved the mystery. He said he finds out that one of the servants was also a servant at the Serency house, and he claims that he watched her and saw her conceal a brickbat about a person and throw it. And she was immediately apprehended, and on fear of being dealt with by the law, she confessed to being that she was the author of the mischief. Well, I'm sure the poor girl did, you know, admit to doing it, but there was absolutely no possible way that this girl could have done the damage that she had done at Serency, or that had been done at Serency.
No, there was too much stuff going on that I don't think a servant would be able to handle all that stuff, because things were happening in front of people and she wasn't anywhere around, really. I mean, people were just seeing it out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, she'd have done well to get the candlestick maker as well from the kitchen up into the bedroom past, you know, Clementine and Mrs. Serency. So, yeah, I don't know how they managed that one.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I've got the newspaper report here as well from the mosquito one. It says, Appling County mystery solved. Again, do the good citizens of the above county rest quiet in their beds. The mystery is cleared up. A few festive mosquitoes of Macon, tired of the dust and monotony of the city and clamorous for more blood, embarked on the excursion and a trip for fun onto the Macon and Brunswick Road a few days since and took up quarters at the house of Mr. Serency, station number 6. At this place, feeling the invigorating influence of country air, unrestrained by bars around beds and intoxicated with fresh blood, they've become just as happy as big sunflowers, and they have been cutting up hijacks. Their size, shape and strengths, flash of their eyes, have misled the people of number 6. Hence, when a mosquito would kick a brickbat down the chimney, back up to the table and shake a book from it, flap a dish from the shelf with its wing and insert its bill into a good-sized hog and drag him through the various rooms of the house. They become superstitious and goblins, evil spirits, and all manner of spiritual mischief makers, and are presumed to be in and about the house.
Yeah, that makes zero sense.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the newspaper was being tongue-in-cheek there.
Yeah, they were probably going for some sort of laugh factor, because, I mean, no, how could you possibly think that that's what was causing these things?
Oh, God knows. God knows. But, yeah, I mean, they've had all manner of things, magnetic force, and because I think there was a bit of a, not a river, but I think there was a bit of a marshy area there. So I think you had the swamp gas, the magnetic force under the house. But then it was like, well, why would one, brick bats aren't magnetic, they're bricks. Bits of wood and the like isn't magnetic. So why on earth would, you know, that cause these things to fly around the house?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I also heard that people were saying that it could have been earthquakes, that there were earthquakes were happening in the house. But then again, that doesn't explain how things were flying across the room. I could understand if things were falling. Yeah. I mean, we have earthquakes here all the time in Southern California. So I know what happens. Things fall off the shelves, glasses fall. And that's just what happens when you're having an earthquake. But you feel it underneath you. You know when there's an earthquake. I've been through a number of earthquakes here, and it's strange, but you can hear it. Like the last one that happened, I remember it was in the middle of the night, and you hear it coming before the house starts shaking. You hear something. Like it's hard to explain.
Really?
It sounds like if shaking had a noise, that's what that noise would be. Like you hear something coming. And then everything starts shaking. So if it was an earthquake, I'm pretty sure they would feel it at their feet. Hey, everything is shaking around here, so that's what's causing it. But it has to be. I mean, there has to be an explanation, really. Be it poltergeists, be it ghosts, it has to be something. Like things just don't really happen like that for zero reason. And with everything stopping with Mrs. Serency, then maybe it was her. It could. I mean, if you really want to take it to the extreme, I can come up with this elaborate hoax that it could be. I guess I can say something like, it's not really a haunting. It's not really a poltergeist. What it really is time travelers from 200 years into the future. They traveled back in time with not telekinetic power, but with mastering teleportation. So they would get inside the house, teleport this into the other room, and then leave out of their tunnel just for fun. I mean, that's another wild explanation, but It could be. You never know.
I know. And this is the thing. I mean, we don't know. It was quite funny, though, because that other haunting that I told you about, the one at St. Neots, they had had things like they had a glass jar. This was in the 40s, I think it was. Now, the husband or the father, because they had a young son, he was a retired Metropolitan Police officer. So, you know, you kind of trust what he's saying. And he said this jar of jam turned up in the hallway and it was frozen solid. And bearing in mind, this was in the days really before you had fridges as well. So let alone freezers. And he said it was raspberry jam. And he said they'd never even had raspberry jam in the house. Yet this jar of jam had turned up, or jelly, I think you guys call it, frozen solid. And they also had a potato thrown at them frozen solid. Yet the Surrency haunting, everything was quite hot to the touch.
Yeah, it could have been, like I said, time travelers. Mischievous time travelers.
Very odd. But also they had the iron grate as well in their from their fire lift up and come flying out of the door and then turned left, flew past his head, and smashed into the door. And it actually broke a piece of the ironwork off as well. You know, so, I mean, again, you've got that force, but the intelligence to turn left out of the door and then go past his head. Oops, I just banged my mic. But yeah, and then turn left and fly past his head. You just think, how the hell do you do it?
I don't know.
It blows my mind. Blows my mind.
It's beyond us now. So, I mean, my time traveler theory is becoming more clear to me. They have the technology to move things that fast 100 years from now. They got time travel abilities. It could be.
I have no idea. All I know is it's been going on for a long, long time. Long time.
Yeah. Good times. But you got anything else you want to say about the Serenity haunting?
No, that's about it. That was my account. But I'd love to know, actually, if anyone is, you know, has been to Serenity or has witnessed these lights as well, the strange lights. Because I've just been getting into this subject, the strange orbs and everything else. So I'd be really interested to hear anyone else's opinions on them, and well, anyone's opinion really on the poltergeist and what they think it is.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I did kind of think of something right now. What do you think happened to all of these items that were being thrown around? Does anything, any of those, you know, personal items still exist? Does somebody like have their stuff? Are there any family members, descendants that are still alive?
Well, I'd say there is. I mean, there was how many of them? 13 of them or something like that, yeah. You know. So there's got to be, as you say, descendants. I'd love to speak to some of them, whether they actually have any family information on it.
Or maybe any of the, you know, their old items are, you know, sitting in an attic somewhere that we can investigate to see if it was time travelers that put little devices on them that would make them do it.
Yes. You're determined it was time travelers.
It has to be. So yeah, I guess that's going to do it for this episode of the Halloween podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to talk about the Serenity haunting some more, you can send me an email at thehalloweenpodcast@gmail.com. You could also go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/thehalloweenpodcast. We're also on Twitter at the Halloween Pod. And yeah, you could go on there, like our stuff, and help us out. And Joe, where can people find you?
Right, you can find us on Facebook. We're on The Defectives. And we are also on Twitter, at Defective Spook. Also, my website, which is thedefectivespodcast.uk. Or you can email us on thedefectivespodcast@gmail.com, which is mail@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming on.
Anytime. I love it.
So wonderful.
You're more than welcome.
Oh, thank you. So yeah, that's going to do it for us. And I'll talk to you next time. Have a good night.
Cool. Take care.